All right. Well, I'm going to start talking. So otherwise, then people can start coming in knowing it's a sign. But this is actually a really critical section. It's kind of about the future of how we get better. And we're going to talk about the three domains that encompass our network. And really, I would really strongly encourage the audience to be involved. And so we really want you guys up at the mic as they're going. There's going to be a little bit of prompts from our speakers and the chairs of the group, but we really want to have a really interactive session. So we're going to start. We start with acute clinically and go to recovery, but we're going to go backwards because we really need to have a lot of focused attention paid in this next 5 years to the recovery. And so we're going to start there. And Steve Kramer is going to,
Thank you. I was just thinking we need to rally the troops. It's so hard when we haven't seen each other in person. So
yes. Yeah. All right, Steve, get them in there.
There we go. Steve's got important things to say.
It's a too social of a group is the problem, which is a good thing. But as I said, we're going to start with recovery. Let me see if I can go back up here. Let's see. And Steve is going to chair this part of the session. We have 45 minutes apiece. So let's get started.
Thanks, Joe. Good morning, everyone, including the slackers coming through the door as we speak. Come on, you tossers, get in here. So it's really early California time. And not all my frontal lobe is woken up yet, so we'll see what we got. So I'm Steve Kramer, stroke neurologist, UCLA, and I'm the chair of the recovery rehab group. And I heard there's some trash talk about rehab recovery when I was still waking up. You didn't feel good about yourselves? Is that good? So Miller Fisher used to say with some frequency that when a stroke occurs, it's because a primary care doc failed at their job. So digest that a minute. So if they're in a rehab recovery trial, prevention, F minus, okay? We know in America, only about 10% of ischemic strokes get reperfusion therapy. I know at your site, it's 21.3, but in the US, it's about 10%. And and half of those still have major disability. That's not controversial, right? So 95% of people with stroke, ischemic stroke, do not benefit substantially from thrombolytics. This is the fact. And then there's the 15% of hemorrhagics where it's irrelevant. So for 95% of your strokes, acute, you got nothing to offer them. They come to rehab recovery. So we're like seeing the masses trying to come up with something new. And we're in a little bit of a disenfranchised situation. Study section is not aligned with some of the most innovative research being proposed to them. Okay, we have to adapt to that. The acute people are beating their chest. The prevention people are growing long gray beards with how many decades they've been at this. And rehab recovery is the new kid on the block. So maybe give us a chance here. We're trying to do some neuroscience. Acute therapies target clots. Clots are acellular jelly balls. Red blood cells aren't cells. They don't have a nucleus. Platelets are just megakaryocyte dandruff. We're trying to reformat the brain here, and it's a new science. Okay, so we sent out the survey too. We got 101 responses, and we're going to talk about those responses as a conduit towards exploring some of the issues unique to rehab recovery trials. And then we're going to have four other people from the rehab recovery group come up and give a quick blurb. And then we're going to open it up to general conversation. Everybody good with that? So we had 101 responses, and we asked a dozen or so questions based on what the rehab recovery group thought was important. And the rehab recovery group, like your group, is about 15 people who are experts in the field, 10 of whom show up at any given time. So one of the problems is that the results are clustered. And so almost everybody liked almost everything. Okay, that's good. It's good to be in an exciting field. So the highest score from 1 to 10, how high a priority is it, was understanding the priorities of patients with stroke. And that's really good. And then other important things were drug trials, collaborating with engineers, attention to caregivers, who, as you may know, have mortality and morbidity issues nearly comparable to those of patients with acute stroke during the year following stroke. Perceived value that stroke rehab recovery trials have, cost, and recruitment training to next generation of trialists. And these are great ideas, and I share them with you today. But let me just spotlight the chip on my shoulder for a second. So anybody talking about priorities of patients with stroke in the prevention? I didn't see that amongst the questions. I didn't see that amongst the 100 comments. Anybody talking about perceived value? No, just hold still on the table, Mr. Jones. We're going to give you a treatment now. So, but when it comes to rehab, we have to consider the perceived value. We have to consider the cost. How much is a jar of TNK, Dr. Kotcher? Do you know?
It must be about 5,000-6,000, right. And only going up, though.
Right.
Got to gonna reach Alta Place soon.
Thank you for allowing me to put you on the spot. So how come we're not talking about 5 or 6K going up? None of the acute questions pertain to cost, not that I saw. And I went through every comment. I didn't see a comment from any 101 people on cost. Yet our feet are being held to the fire here. So just remember, the prevention didn't prevent it. Acute didn't cut it down. We're trying to bring some neuroscience and make it happen. And look at the fire our feet are being held to, inconsistent with the other branches of stroke. So, you know, maybe give us a chance. Did you know that StrokeNet peer review group has only funded one adult clinical trial so far in 10 years? We're struggling to get through here, okay? And that's Transport 2, and we're very grateful to have it on board. So what are some of the unique challenges in relation to stroke recovery rehab trials? Well, it's a young field. And like any young field, you're going to get less money than cardiology. So I just did a little search in PubMed. I typed in the words, quote, stroke recovery. And it's pretty much an asymptote on the left poll going out to 1995. But you can see that this is a hot young field, right? So we can lean into it, or we could speak disparagingly of it when its group leader is not present. And the biomarkers are still being defined. Oh, you champions of diffusion perfusion, you CBF, CBFVers. We don't have that. We're struggling to create that, right? So you must be patient. You must foster growth in this young field, okay? And sometimes the biomarkers are unfamiliar. Now, I know you like to park in the same space and order the same CT stroke and, you know, sit in the same chair during stroke round, but we're the new kids in block, on the block. We got new stuff going on here. And you can be like the ostrich with your head in the sand there, or you can embrace the new biomarkers. And we're still trying to sort it out. So let's talk about some of the neuroscience behind some of the biomarkers. One of them is TMS. So many of you are members of the Verify study. On behalf of Achilla, Kathy, Pooja, and myself, we thank you. Verify says, you know how when people leave the hospital, we're really not so sure exactly what's going to happen, and we're making triage decisions and spending billions of dollars based on best guessed hip shot? Maybe we could put some science into that. And so there's some evidence that physiology and anatomy predict day 90 outcomes better than anything you can do at the bedside. And you're pretty good at the bedside. So this is an example of TMS. If you're not familiar, it stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation, because it shoots magnetic pulses through the cranium and hits the brain, which is an electrical sheet. And if you remember your Faraday history, that causes the nerve cells to fire. You zap a magnetic pulse on one side of the brain and you get a muscle twitch on the other side of the body, okay? And you can use TMS if you turn the dial up way high to treat depression, to treat OCD, it's FDA approved. But this is single pulse. You go pop, a little magnetic pulse, and you get a twitch or not. Turns out if they have a twitch or not, and I've shown you an EMG twitch, if they have a twitch or not from the EMG leads here, they do a lot better than people who have no preserved physiologic integrity. You turn the unit up to 100%, you're zapping, nothing happened on the other muscle. That's a bad predictor. We want to put that on the map. I honestly believe that in 10 years, all of you will be paying physical therapists to do this between day 2 and 4 for your people on the stroke ward who have non-minor strokes. Anyhow, we have unusual biomarkers. We're trying to bring new neuroscience into recovery and repair, into plasticity in the realm of stroke. So be patient with us, be supportive. Patients often need many treatment sessions. Now, last time I checked, an acute reperfusion kind of had one treatment session, right? Prevention, I'm not an expert, so all right. But, you know, you give them the pack of the green pills and they go home, maybe you call them a week or two later, maybe. But we got to love our patients every day. So the first time you learned to walk, you were on average age 14 months. And how many times did you have to write the letter S before you finally stopped making it backwards, right? The human brain grows from practice. It's experience-dependent plasticity, right? And so if you have somebody who has a stroke and they got a new hole in their brain and you want to reformat the surviving brain elements to produce a gain in function, a gain in behavioral status, you're going to have to drill it into them, all right? And that takes a lot of practice. And they're not going to do it on their own. You give them a little mimeograph, flex your elbow 100 times, they, right, doc. So it takes a lot of work to do a rehab recovery trial. And, you know, you can sprinkle any magic pixie dust growth factor or stem cell you want on the injured brain. You're still going to have to reinforce those galvanized circuits with practice. And that's hard, getting people to do stuff. So I like what Carl Ashley, one of my heroes, said. After extensive lesions, the amount of training necessary to reestablish the habits is much increased. So you thought it was hard to learn the oboe as an adult. Try learning the oboe as an adult with a hole in your brain, right? In an active StrokeNet trial now, iAcquire, they have 20 treatment sessions in one of the active arms. And in the tele-rehab trial, which StrokeNet sponsored early on, they had 36 treatment sessions, okay? Can you imagine having to arrange for a patient to come in and get a groin puncture 36 times over 6 weeks? That is quite something. So be patient with us as we figure out how to apply the best neuroscience to the emerging science of stroke recovery rehab. Patients often change treatment settings during the trial because, you know, you wouldn't want it to be easy or anything, but they leave the acute hospital. They either go to a SNF or inpatient rehab and then home, but some go to a long-term facility and some bounce back to the SNF. And it's complicated. And if you want to have continuity of care during those precious golden weeks, it certainly introduces complexities. They often require multidisciplinary teams. So just by show of hands, raise your hand if you know the name of at least one neuroradiologist in your facility. Okay, almost everybody, hands down. Raise your hand if you know the name of at least one speech therapist in your facility. It's better than I expected, and some of you may be liars. Okay. My point here is that in the acute stroke world, we're very accustomed to multidisciplinary teams, right? Some of us involve anesthesia with our hyperacute patients. We certainly work with the ER docs, radiology, the list goes on. But in rehab recovery, the clinical teams are very different. It's OT and PT and speech therapy. There might be neuropsychology involved. The case manager may be as important as the physician for some things that have to happen. You get the idea. It's new teams. It's a new domain. It's a new side of the Wild West, right? So that's a complex challenge for stroke rehab recovery. This is actually a great talk to give when you're sleepless and your flight was canceled, because I'm just really sharing it with you. We study unfamiliar forms of intervention. You know what happens if you give TPA during stroke recovery? They bleed. What do you think? We're not giving your grandfather's aspirin. We're trying new things. We're zapping the brain. Have you ever zapped a brain? Not most of us haven't. That's new, right? Or we're injecting growth factors or stem cells. That's an exciting thing, but it's new and it's unfamiliar. It certainly scares the heck out of a lot of the reviewers. You have to be patient as we sort through the best preclinical evidence to try it in humans. So here's one study. This is Transport 2, which is the adult study that study section has thought was worth pursuing. And we're happy to have Wayne and Gottfried, the PIs, here with us today. And this is where you just look at the image on your left. You put a couple of wet salines on the cap there, on the gauze, on the head, and you connect it to a little battery, and you hit go, according to some programming. And you can see them attached here on the head of a crash test dummy. I guess because crash test dummies incur a lot of brain injury in their occupation. Thanks, Wayne. Anyhow, it's pretty simple to go on. And if it works, it'll be pretty easy to translate into phase four. But this is unusual. It's uncommon. And for many of you, it's arcane. And this is the kind of stuff that we're trying to bring the best evidence from animals into human trials. It's not your grandmother's catheter. All right. We often use detailed endpoints, and some require special expertise. So it continues to blow my mind that the acute stroke mafia likes the Rankin and Rankin only. I get that Rankin detects the salvage of 30 or 40 cc's of brain, and it can be done over the phone. And so it works, so you stick with it. That's great. But can you imagine a neurologist or a neurology nurse walks into a room, spends 20, 30 minutes with a complex patient, walks out of the room, and says, three. And the residents are like, did you think the apraxia was interfering, or did you think that was more of an aphasia? Can you count? Right. So if Rankin works, power to you. And I'm sure if recovery had a 30-second endpoint, we would use it as well. But we don't. We have to decide which neural system is injured. If language is blown away, they're globally aphasic, there's nothing they're going to do, then you're probably not going to treat it too much or see too much gains. But the arm might get better or gait might improve. So we have to decide which flavor of the human we're treating that we're going to follow over time is salvageable, is treatable. Also, if vision is unchanged, we're not going to treat it. So we have to do lots of measures. This very group endorsed the opinion, see it says opinions in green, that we should consider domain-specific endpoints in acute trials, but they're also the things that we rely upon in rehab recovery trials. You can see we can measure depression. It only takes a minute or two. Throw that in your acute trial. We can do a simple test of neglect and language. Why? Because we have increased resolution into what's going on beyond a single digit, sometimes a single binary digit. We have better insight into recovery, and we can learn about individual brain systems. Just to give you one example why this might be helpful. This is a paper we had in neurology last year. So each row is a different domain-specific endpoint. Let's look at the top one, which is arm motor, okay? So within people who have a Rankin of three, arm motor function can be anything from normal to nearly nothing. So what is the Rankin telling you about? It's telling you about how well they adapted after the stroke as influenced by their neurologic deficit. But when you want to get down to the brain, you've got to say, what's going on with the brain? Not do they have support, not are they depressed or not, not is anxiety intruded. And look, for a Rankin of two and a Rankin of three, you have a very similar range of values for arm motor impairment. Same is true for gait velocity here. Gait velocity, which is the sixth vital sign, can be widely varying across Rankin of two versus three. So you get the idea that global endpoints are useful, but if in rehab recovery, you might have to get into some nitty-gritty details. Though they can be resource intensive, they can require expertise, they can be less familiar to people, and they may require special hardware or kits at times. So something to think about. Let's talk about opportunities in StrokeNet. So again, with my magnificent chip on my shoulder, I see mom and dad, loving sister and brother, so much more. And so I make noise in the back seat. These are the three silos of StrokeNet. This is acute, this is prevention, and obviously the big one is rehab recovery, but size doesn't matter. I'll stop talking. So we are three independent channels when we could be functioning more as one. This is my perspective. The acute stroke is an excellent channel. Prevention is an excellent channel, but nary a recovery thought occurs within the silo. And my point is, why don't we all collect PHQ-8? Why don't we all collect an anxiety scale? Why don't we all collect the box and blocks arm function test, which takes about 60 seconds and you could have done when you were 7 years old, right? You could have administered when you're 7, right? Why don't we have certain common endpoints and start doing big data across all of the all trials? There should be a suggested set of endpoints that we all include. Maybe we can integrate recovery trials into acute and prevention. I'm out of time, so I'm not going to speculate on what that might look like, but maybe when you're done with them, or maybe there's a reasonable way to integrate things. Maybe we can join forces for patient recruitment. If you don't want them, give us a holler. Or maybe we actually alternate and play fairly in the sandbox. right? Something along these lines. So those are some thoughts. Thank you for your time.
Okay, Cheryl and I are going to talk about challenges in recruitment for rehab and recovery trials. All right, so I kind of divide these into some problem statements. Problem statement one, recovery trials can't enroll stroke patients who don't live next to a large rehab center. So this is a map of our enrollments from our grant, from where we had enrolled patients in the last 5 years. And you can tell they're really spread out. And this is a real problem for us. I just asked my Kinga, why we weren't in transport two. She goes, remember, they're too far away. I was like, oh, that's right. So we have a big problem with this. And even the patients who are urban can't always get there. And I think, I know that Steve just had a lot of provocative statements, but one of them was we're going to use a lot of fancy equipment and do a lot of stuff that's difficult. And that doesn't always work for our patients who are far away from us. This is another example of a great, lots and lots of outcomes, but that this causes us problems for patients who are far away because they can't do them remotely. Our second problem statement, non-academic center participation lags. And so I know earlier we were asking about how do you get your sites to be engaged? And this is another map from this is our network. You can tell the cluster, a little grape cluster there in the middle is the Salt Lake Valley and actually a little bit south of us. But these other places are pretty small centers. Some of them are even big centers, but none of them are academic medical centers. And so they don't have TMS or they don't have the money to float some of these coordinator time or PT time to have them really fully participate in trials. And so we're really struggling to get these sites to be able to do rehab and recovery trials. In addition, there's some what I call the stroke severity hospital mismatch. We tend to get the most severe stroke patients. They tend to get the milder ones. And then it's opposite of that in terms of who can enroll what. So what do our remote and transportation challenged patients want? And this really, for those of you who are designing trials or trying to re-envision trials, patients want their in-person visits to be flipped to remote visits at any time. This is a huge deal for our patients. They want to do telemed or phone-based follow-ups. They don't want to have to come back in person for every follow-up. This is one that our CTSI, I'm bringing up the CTSAI quite a bit today, but we have a element E, as it's called, trying to do this currently, where we could do blood draws remotely in communities. I mean, it's completely ridiculous to have to drive several hours to come back and get your blood drawn. MRI is the same thing. If you need specialized sequences, you have to come back. But what if we could get MRIs wherever they live? And last is really to receive research in their communities and not have to come all the way to us. So what do our coordinators and PIs want? We also want flexibility and method of follow-up. We live in a snow state. We had record snow last year, and every single visit, people would call up the day before, I'm not coming. And so then we're out of the window. So we have to be able to flip these to telemed. Here's another big pet peeve. I'm up here pet peeving today. We want the same reimbursement for remote and in-person visits, which you might be surprised to hear that is not the case for all trials. In some cases, when we flip to telemed, we're paid less money. And that's a huge problem for us because we've prepared, it's the same amount of work for us on the RCC side. If the team travels to the patient, we'd like to be reimbursed for that too. And we also will try to do that to keep patients in trials. And then last, we want a trial that's inclusive of all of our sites, even the non-academic centers and community hospitals without fancy equipment and therapists who need salary support. And again, that's hard. I realize that what, you know, Dr. Kramer's presenting and what I'm presenting are a little bit at odds, but it really means that we're looking for pragmatic trials that all of our sites can run. So that might mean that some of our outcomes assessments are telemed-based, tablet-based, web forms, wearables. There's all kinds of things that we can do. I would propose there might be two types of outcomes assessment. Maybe you do one thing that's more rigorous in person and a second one remote. I know the people in the stats world find that very problematic, but I think it might help us to be able to enroll more trials. And then I would say if trials cannot be pragmatic, should RCCs be penalized for not being able to broadly run them? In other words, maybe the target isn't all of the hospitals. Maybe it's just the big academic centers or the RCCs. Or is StrokeNet even the right mechanism for some of these? I mean, I do think that's a serious question if we can't design trials that all of our hospitals can run. Again, just to be pet peeving and a chip on my shoulder here. Okay, that was my spiel. Off to Cheryl.
Thanks, Jenny. I just really come at this from somebody who really cares about the whole patient and the whole continuum of care. So I love telestroke. I love taking care of patients in the hospital. But I am also just as passionate about the prevention and the recovery. And so I just want to get us to start thinking broadly about rehab and recovery designs and how you could have a combination of acute and recovery trials. And just as an example, your first aim could be we're testing an acute treatment and we're using the modified Rankin score scale. The second aim, or maybe these could be reversed, that we're going to continue to do follow-up with rehab intervention. It could be a structured therapy or coaching and have a patient-centered recovery outcome. And to Jenny's point, the concept of decentralized outcome assessments can be used to accommodate remote recruitment and retention. And then there's also the option of combining recovery and prevention trials. And this is the Sleep Smart example, but it could also be that you have a prevention strategy that's your primary outcome or endpoint is recurrent stroke or major adverse cardiovascular event or imaging, and you use a 1 to 2 year endpoint. But you could also be testing the impact of a prevention strategy on recovery, such as cognition, quality of life, function, et cetera. And again, the concept of decentralized outcome assessments and more pragmatic approaches to collecting endpoints could be something that we could think about as a group. And that is it for us.
Well, Steve called me the brains up and guy, so I'll take that. So, you know, motor impairment, the most common impairment after stroke. So for the first three recovery study funded by, you know, StrokeNet, you know, Transport 2, iQuery, Verify, we all target actually motor impairment, but there are so many complications, pain, spasticity, depression, you know, incontinence, sexual dysfunction, seizures, you know, aphasia, dysphagia. There's so many of those. But if you look at a guideline, you know, look at a level one, level two evidence-based treatment, literally there's none. So this is a barrier, but I see great opportunity because brain stimulation actually emerged as a very important tools. We're doing TDCS, but TDCS for motor impairment, but also used for aphasia, actually had a pretty good evidence also for, you know, for aphasia. So I think as a group, we should really think about how we can call for more brain stimulation study, also target those non-motor complications. So that's my number one point. My number two is, I have to see, but what is number two? number two is, I actually have great slides where I can show you. we actually pulled all the stroke motor recovery study published top 10 in a stroke related journal or recovery journal. And we look at the enrollment for gender and also minority group, but the number is actually a little bit astonishing low. In Transport 2, we implemented several strategies we thought would be good to sort of kind of share with you, also incur some discussions. In Transport 2, you know, 50% enrollment actually are non-Caucasian, really pretty good representation of the real world and patient demographics. So one of the few things I think is really important, one is, Steve would talk about, you know, 20 treatment sessions. Oh, yeah, that's great. Can you connect?
No.
Okay. I can get all great pictures. Yeah. One that really we focus on is really actually increase the payment. As we know, in a minority group, actually, they are more likely to live away from the academic center. So we actually implement strategy, actually, if they live away about either 60 miles away or 90 minutes one way, they actually can apply additional and 250. In the end, we actually increase 500. So they can use the money just for gas, whatever, stay in a hotel. That really kind of, help us to enroll as a minority group to the study, also make sure we retain the endpoint. So our primary endpoint rates actually are almost 94% despite all COVID. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, you really think about it is you ask them to volunteer their time. You have to take care transportation, you know, parking, maybe sometimes lunch. For example, transport two, you know, they stay in the lab for 3 and 4 hours. Most of the time that you stay across the lunch time. So really what you really think about is, you know, how we can take care of all those things just as a patient volunteer their time. So I think that should help. My last point is, as Steve said, recovery is a new kid in the horizon. You know, we really need to focus on outcome standardizations. When I was a resident, the first thing I would start rotating on the stroke service, attending asked me to do NIH stroke scale and do the modified ranking scale. But I was never asked to learn how to do the, you know, Fugama motor scales. You know, never learn how to do the Boston aphasia scales. I don't know how to do the, you know, the cancellation test. So I think really we need to emphasize recovery is important and still facing humanity issues. We really try to spend efforts how to standardize. The one way to standardize and increase and consistent across sites, ask more people to do those tests. So in transport two, we also implement very rigorous and a Fugama and motor scale standardization process. Not only they have to pass online, they have to attend workshop, and they also send a videotape centrally and adjudicate it. And then every 4 patient and enrollment, they have to do recertify. So, you know, shockingly, the first time the passing rates for the Fugama was really just about 60%. But once they learn the process of recertify, they, you know, second time recertify, they almost like 100%. We just need to, you know, do more and more, and so we can get there.
Hello.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much, Frank.
All right. I volunteered to give up my time. Let's see if I can do this in 1 minute. As Steve has already talked about a number of different things, I'm the last person here. So I'll just make a plug that we hope that in this next cycle, we'll get an opportunity to really study various other experimental interventions. Neurostimulation made it through. Congrats to Wayne and Gottfried on that. We have to work together to see that we can get other interventions, how we can convince our peer review to be able to study other interventions is how I'll put it. So pharmacological agents, cell-based therapies, certainly there are common themes even maybe during the review processes that have occurred for various other recovery studies. Maybe we could see if there's pattern analysis here as a group that we could address you know, common themes if they are. And it would be wonderful to consider once the OTA for the STEP platform is implemented. Could we learn from that? Could we get an opportunity to think about platform trials for recovery studies? I am very enthusiastic about wanting to implement platform trials for recovery studies. I certainly think that could be done. And shameless plug, it's gratuitous, and this was Dr. Kramer's idea, not mine, to actually just put out there for one specific example of an experimental intervention. This is a forest plot showing the various animal studies that support cell-based therapies in animal models of stroke. There are thousands of studies that have been done. The slide is difficult to read because there's just so many studies, 15 to 20 years now, that we have looked at. So we are hoping that eventually we will get through on a study that's going through peer review for the third time. But it's just an example. There is a lot of animal literature to support our interventions in recovery. And we just wanted to make sure that that is emphasized over and over again. And the last thing is that a number of colleagues have been coming together to think about for the gaps that have been identified when it comes to recovery compared to acute and prevention. There is a lack of, let's say, training and understanding about how to do recovery research. So we have been thinking about putting a proposal together, and this has gone through the recovery work group. Some of the leadership here has seen this before. But what we're thinking about is, given that there's more than 150 rehab centers that are in StrokeNet, a real unique opportunity here to leverage the expertise of the network to address gaps in training and education. Could we create a StrokeNet rehab program of training and educational core? We could build the next generation of clinical and academic partners within rehab facilities, conducting high quality research. And perhaps that would be another way forward for us all to work together in that respect. I will stop there.
Who has questions, comments, queries, thoughts, speculations?
Hi, Bernadette Bodenau-Balla, University of California, Irvine. I guess thoughts and questions. One is sort of the use of community health workers. It's something that we're doing in terms of task shifting. So moving some tasks out of coordinator into community health workers, out into community. We've done things like rent space in community, do outcome assessments for trials in community. So one thing we should probably think about over the next 5 years is how we could think about community health workers, right? It's they're great liaisons into the community. Second thing, a trial that I did not get accepted through StrokeNet, but did in another agency, which is now a primary prevention. So doing primary prevention and secondary prevention at the same time, using families in communities. You talked about how you could do primary and secondary. So I think that there are some ways, and maybe even thinking about a conference to discuss sort of how to align primary prevention, treatment, and recovery trials together. So two things.
Thanks, Bernadette. I agree with the community health workers. Patients who are doing rehab and recovery are generally living in the community at some point. So that's a good idea.
Bernadette, I love the idea. We're doing that in Texas. So we've got great community engagement through our CTSA. There's the what Jenny just mentioned. So I think we definitely should be broadening and amplifying on that.
Question on our right.
Scott Kasner from University of Pennsylvania. So you guys talked about common endpoints in trials, which seems like a really efficient way to buy one endpoint, get three free. Just sort of curious if you want to elaborate on what that might look like. And in particular, from a grantsmanship perspective, if you throw in these additional endpoints, how do you avoid confusing reviewers about power and sample size and focus and those kinds of things as well?
Well, first we have to break the reviewers out of Rankin Valley fever. I mean, there's more to a patient than just that single digit. But one can emphasize that one can interpret the main results through the lens of the various flavors that make up a human, emotionally, physically, functionally, and so forth. And there are some endpoints that are pretty quick and easy that could be done in a few minutes. I don't know, Sean, you have something to add to that? It looked like you were leaning in.
Oh, no.
Oh, just a little spinal dystonia.
Following. No, I just think, we're going to have to get more creative with regards to rank ordering our endpoints and thinking about more about co-primaries and so forth.
Yeah. Thank you. Very good question. Ben?
Pat Layden from USC. So I want to ask a question to each of you. Following up on the slide, forest plot, of a huge number of animal studies that support cell-based therapy. I would argue that the quantity of the single lab studies is not as important as the quality of the research that's done. Yeah. And you've done a great job today of describing barriers and problems in the clinical trial side. But I'm curious about how you feel on the preclinical side. Do you feel like you have the models and the tools and the systems that when a therapy comes to you to do a clinical trial that you're confident there's a high likelihood of success? Basically, do you see a need for a span type of effort in the recovery rehab world?
Well, let me get the chance to speak before Steve. Actually it was Steve before me who published on the fact that actually, if you look at the quality of these preclinical studies and cell-based therapies, there's more of an effect size in those studies that actually had higher quality when you looked at the methodological rigor of those studies, in contrast to the neuroprotection literature, where it looked like it was quite the opposite. So that's interesting. And it was part of a story of that perhaps the animal model literature that came after neuroprotection learned maybe a couple of lessons that Pat and many other leaders were emphasizing for so many years. But I personally would love to see SPAN expand into recovery, if that were possible. I think that would be a great benefit.
And as always, I think there is great value in planning with preclinical and clinical seated at the same table. I would suggest that no preclinical study should be done without a clinician on the board, and no clinical study should be translated without the preclinical investigator sitting side by side. StrokeNet is an opportunity to explore that approach if preferred. Lori?
Hi, Lori Richards from University of Utah. I've actually thought for a long time that we should be combining at least acute and rehab trials, and now maybe slightly secondary prevention and rehab trials for two reasons. One, I can't believe it wouldn't be more efficient to do that. Yeah, we'd have to have more groups, so we'd have a bigger trial. But when you think about the costs of setup and getting things going, it would seem likely, you know, have four groups where they get the acute or not, and they get the rehab or not, right? And the second reason is there's huge variety in our trials at how many people either don't get any rehab, get rehab in an IRF, which is much more intensive, get rehab in a SNF, which isn't very, or go home and get some kind of maybe three outpatient settings or whatever, right? And so we've already got that variety, and it just seems logical to me that it would make sense to combine those kinds of trials.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think that's really important. And the other thing too is that there's so many aspects of prevention, for example, blood pressure management that impacts cognition, for example, which is an extremely important outcome after stroke. And so there's just so many dots that are already connected that we could take advantage of. Thanks.
I also against the idea to incorporate recovery study embedded into the acute studies. I think overall, the effect size for recovery intervention at this moment is very small. That's what we all struggle for. If you look at the TPA altipase study or any of somnolytics or thrombectomy studies, they have a very large effect size. In those trials, they never really quantify the amount of rehab. So it means rehab probably doesn't really matter as much in those acute trials because the effect size from the acute intervention is very big. But I think so far, as a recovery group, we really need to think about some really revolutionary treatment has a decent and effect size. But right now, the effect size overall is small. That's what we struggle for. Maybe we didn't have a good understanding about the pathophysiology.
It's not like a piece of chewing gum where you're done with it and you spit it out. We have one patient in our network. We should continue to study them. They've shown a willingness to be in research. They're well characterized acutely. It just seems to me that we're missing an opportunity in terms of databasing and sequential trial enrollment and unifying the three silos of our field.
Hi, Hina Lavalde from the University of Iowa. I'm one of the RCC managers and also a study coordinator. And I think it's really helpful for not just the RCC managers, coordinators, but also for our fellows to get some of this training with some of the rehab scales like the Fugelmeyer. We're all trained on NIH stroke scale modified Rankin, but I think this is a really great area to bring back to the two education course for the fellows and for the coordinators. Another aspect to keep in mind is with these trials, the coordinators tend to follow these patients throughout the course of the study. And so if we can get that training with some of the rehab skills, we can definitely bring that back for when they come back to see us in 3 months, bring it back to the clinician if we're noticing things. So just something to keep in mind if maybe you want to incorporate the two education cores to push out some of this training and education to everybody.
I completely agree with you. If you look at the ACGME vascular neurology requirement for the fellows and you search for recovery, there's only one bullet. So a lot of fellows are they are well equipped with acute treatment prevention, but I would say most of fellows, they are not equipped for recovery. Like spasticity, the most common complication, nobody really know how to treat it. How many, stroke neurology actually doing, botulinum toxin, or let's leave it aside, maybe it's a little controversial, but no one really teaches those kind of technique during the fellowship.
Two more questions because we're almost at our time. So,
okay,
Philip, one here.
Phil, and then
Phil.
Philip Scott, University of Michigan. Mine's a pragmatic RCC question. Pre-COVID, we had a number of robust specialty rehab hospitals that were participating. COVID seemed to affect those disproportionately to our acute care hospitals, and they have not yet completely recovered. I'm curious, are you all seeing this phenomenon in other areas of the country?
I guess I'd have to ask the audience. For me, no, but that's because we have a different setup, so I don't think I'm the right person to ask. Our rehab hospital is attached to our hospital, so it hasn't had that.
Specific rehab hospitals.
Yeah,
I'd say in Houston, we've had a big change in the landscape. Several of the inpatient rehab facilities have disappeared, and we have now more for-profit organizations that have come into town.
Eva?
Right. Before I ask my question, I will defend acute trialists and obsession with MRS a little bit. Steve, you're part of one of our studies where we're looking at a lot of granular outcomes, and so that is coming. We don't love MRS either, but that's a segue to my point, and probably you can comment on this, is a domain-specific outcomes when you think about rehab. To me, it almost seems like that would limit the participants that you can enroll in the trial if you're just using domain-specific outcomes. If you go MyRehab, you have certain kind and type of weakness to be in the trial to begin with. And then it becomes an issue training on multiple domain-specific outcomes for these coordinators. They're not using them that often because participants are not being qualified because you're using a very specific, you know, outcome measure. Wondering if that is the right way to go. Clearly, it is based on your statement, but I just wanted to kind of rethink and see if we should, as a community, come up with a couple of very sensitive but global outcome measures for rehab that can increase, you know, pool of participants, but still captures, you know, that granularity of rehabilitation. Just wanted to make the point.
Thank you. That's a great goal. The alternatives might be worse, though, even though the cure might be difficult.
Yeah, just one comment in the chat is and this is from Stephen Wolf. I wonder how many neurologists undertake a rehab rotation during their residency.
Not many. About as many stroke fellows.
That'd be an interesting question to ask out to all of our sites with stroke fellows. How many have rehab as part of their just as in terms of not many, right? So probably less than half. So that may be something to think
unless
about.
That's all the
PIs. Yeah. So
25 sites.
Yeah. So that'd be a good question maybe to ask as a survey. But we are at the witching hour, witching 45 minutes. Steve and team, great discussion. Lots to chew on. But yes, it's the biggest population of patients. Yes, it's all new. We got to get it through review. We got to work on outcomes, and we got to join forces. That's kind of what I hear as a summary of things. So thanks so much.